Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Twitter, Trump, and the First Amendment. And Richard, we turn today to New York, where a three-judge panel on the Second Circuit ruled unanimously that it's unconstitutional for President Trump to block followers on Twitter. Now, for our listeners who are sane enough to stay off of Twitter, if you block someone, it means they can't read your tweets, at least not while they're logged into their account, and also that they can't interact by replying to your content, which is especially relevant here. And the court ruled that, contra the president's assertion that this was his private account and he could do what he wants, that he was conducting government business on this account. He makes a lot of official pronouncements on it. And thus, he did not have the right to selectively exclude people that he disagrees with. So why don't you just start by getting us situated here with First Amendment law? Why is it so important to the court's analysis that the president is blocking people based on their point of view as opposed to some other reason?
Okay, well, there are multiple issues going on here. Let's start with the point of view, and then we have to talk about the public forum. The First Amendment essentially is a freedom of speech doctrine, which by and large has been construed pretty much in classical liberal terms. So when you start looking at the kind of justifications that you could have for restricting speech, it turns out that they're very familiar. You can restrict it because it's a threat or intimidation. You could restrict it because it's fraud or non-disclosure. You could restrict it because it's part of a monopoly practice. But what you're not allowed to do is to restrict speech under those circumstances in which you create a transfer of wealth from one group of speakers to another, because cross subsidies, which the classical liberal believes ought to be never done anywhere and competition never allows them, cannot, in addition, be done in this particular case. So viewpoint discrimination is essentially saying these guys get by and the other guys don't get by. And so if you suppress one point of view when you allow the other, it's like an implicit wealth transfer between them. So there is virtually a per se rule out there that when you're talking about ordinary speakers on their own time, is that any statute which starts to give you that kind of a benefit is going to be bad. Now, the converse is you have now these things which are neutral in some sense as between two parties. Presumptively, those regulations that are neutral will, generally speaking, be upheld, but this is a much more complicated analysis because oftentimes something turns out to be neutral on its face but have a disparate impact, like any other discrimination law. Sometimes that disparate impact is intended, sometimes it's not. And so wherever you see it and whenever you see it intentionally, there are some people who are going to say what you have to do is to back off of that particular regulation, even though a more neutral in impact, time, place, or manner regulation is going to be allowed. So that's the basic architecture of the First Amendment. It's basically you don't require one speaker to subsidize another. Now, that's when people are just speaking on their own places at their own time. But a public forum gives rise to sort of additional complications because this is the classic commons. And again, you have to start with Roman law. And the basic essence of a commons is it's a situation where nobody has the right to exclude anybody else and everybody else has the right to be there. And so then the question is, well, how do you organize a conference of a commons if everybody wants to come on there? And you then realize that you really do have to have time, place, and manner rules, because if a bunch of people all want to get there at the same time and they all want to use banjos and loud systems, you can stop that stuff. But there's an extremely powerful obligation that you have to be sort of neutral with respect to this so that people of different points of views can get on that forum. Now, sometimes you don't have to allow them all on at the same time. You can sequence it so one person has the rally today, someone has it tomorrow, one person has it on the west side of town, somebody else has it on the east side of town. And so there are huge management problems and a very large body of law asking such questions. If you want to protest a political action by sleeping on the commons, can they take a neutral law and throw you off even though your opponents don't bother to sleep? The answer to that question is probably yes, they can throw you off, but not in all cases. Then there's also the question as to whether or not if you are to take the old case, you are the Irish in Boston. You want to have the St. Patrick's Day parade. And at the time, they did not want to admit gay people to it. Could they run their parade without gay membership? And the Supreme Court was quite emphatic. This is a private group on a public road. But so long as other private groups can get on the public road, they're entitled to include who their memberships are and whom to exclude. So it's a very muddy volume of law. Now, in this case, the public forum is said to be the president, which is kind of odd. I mean, it's not a physical place in some sense. But what happens is when you have the answering space, you could kind of analogize those things to a commons. And generally speaking, everybody has a right to come on to a common. And if you then start looking at the opinion, they use phrases like free and robust debate. And that's exactly the phrase that was used in New York Times against Sullivan by Justice Brennan to stop the defamation suits that might have shut down the New York Times. And so their position is, look, it's a kind of a weird public forum. It's in the technical age, but the First Amendment doesn't deal with physics. It deals with electronics. It deals with digital space. It's quite clear that the president is using this as a political microphone. And I think the court was right to say, if it's a political microphone, it doesn't matter if it's quote-unquote privately owned. You are the president of the United States. You're giving your political stuff through this, so you can't get people off. And my view is what Trump should have done, which he never would do, is to say, they want to comment. There's 62 million people on my side. By all means, be my guest. And if I think they're really out of line, then I will single them out for various kinds of abuse and opprobrium in my conventional fashion. So I think this was a political mistake. And I think on balance, the decision was probably correct.
So one of the arguments that the president's lawyers made, I hinted at this a little in the earlier question, but they said, this is not an official presidential account. This is not an account that's run by the White House. It's the same account he's had since he was a private citizen, and he started this, I believe, in 2009. And so they argued that in the same way that Mar-a-Lago is not now government property because Trump does official business there sometimes, the Twitter account should not be considered a government Twitter account. Does that persuade you at all?
Well, I mean, it does. I don't regard this as a fatuous or a foolish argument. The problem about this is that the president would be on a lot better ground if he had an official voice pass on the one hand and a private place on the other. And so if he decided in response to all of this to segregate his business, and what he did is, in effect, he did all of his government business on one account and all his private stuff on another account, you could see how he could claim that. The problem, of course, is the stuff that he most cares about is the public stuff. And he puts that on a private situation, everybody's going to say that it's some kind of a ruse. This is one of these things where sort of obvious physical analogies really don't work particularly well. But I think what everybody else is going to say is, if you are using this private forum for your public purposes, then in effect you can't get people off of it. And the question is, what does it mean to get off of it? Well, in this particular case, all you're saying is that you can't write comments. They're not trespassing on the land. Whereas with Mar-a-Lago, if he says anything there, they could certainly answer it. What they're not allowed to do is to enter the particular property, but that's true when he says something from the White House. So I think the distinctive nature of the particular medium makes it more likely than not that since this is not an intrusion on his physical space, but it's something that's going on in cyberspace, it doesn't have any of the ugly connotations associated with stampeding the White House or Mar-a-Lago. I think the president is probably going to lose on that argument, although you understand where it's coming from. He mixes the two accounts together. And there's no alternative way that people can protest as far as they're concerned unless they could get on to log on to those particular situations. And he's opened it up to some people. Can he then selectively close it off to other people? It's there. I think it's not a frivolous complaint, but I think in the end it's probably not a successful one. To my mind, the president is having a losing battle. What he should do is say, welcome him on, and then continue to attack if he wants to. Or assume that, you know, if you've got 62 million followers and somebody wants to do one of these things, it's not as though every one of your followers is going to read every one of these particular tweets. And if you really try to keep them off, then other people are going to start to do this. And you don't want, as the president, to be in a position where you're going to have to throw off 500,000 people because all of them are saying harsh things about you. So my view about this is it's a political defeat for the president. I don't think it's a large one. I think he should have basically preempted it by saying, by all means, come here. You're not coming on the White House lawns after all. Say your piece, and then I will say mine. Because what you can do is you could isolate the intellectual content of what you say from any physical presence on anybody else's property. And what people are upset about in the White House case is they're coming on the land. They're not upset about the fact that these people are saying things that are critical of the president. And so if you've got that separation in the physical cases, then I think you should have it here. And since there's no physical entry, I don't think that the comparison for the president really works.
We should note, too, there's another alternative that I believe was floated in the case, which is Twitter does have a mute function, which would have allowed the president not to have seen these comments, but people still would have had access to his account, would have been able to read the content. So, Richard, let me get you to respond to a couple of criticisms of this decision that have come from the right today, from people with legal backgrounds. The first, David French, writing at National Review, no fan of Donald Trump's,
yes,
says that the judges made some fundamental conceptual mistakes. The first of which he argues is that Trump actually doesn't control, in the full sense of the word, his Twitter account. Twitter does. And so he can only use it as long as or to the extent that they allow him. They do ban people. You know, we've seen that. So French's argument is that the analogy here is to being a guest on a call-in radio show, and that because it's someone else's platform, the same strictures shouldn't apply to Trump. How do you react to that?
I don't like the argument at all. I mean, Twitter is a common carrier. A talk show host is an individual with decided points of view. Twitter, when it does this stuff, usually has some kind of protocols that it follows. Political hosts are always entitled to invite the guests that they want on the show and to keep anybody else off. So if you start looking at the Decency Act and a lot of other stuff, it turns out that the distinction between a telecommunications network like Twitter and a host is absolutely important on such questions about libel. The Community Decency Act has a complete exemption for the pipes that send the thing through. There's no exemption from defamation law for people who actually run it. And so if the analogy that Mr. French is making is carried over to other areas of established internet law, it breaks down.
When this case was in the lower court, Greg Dolan at the University of Baltimore School of Law made this argument in National Review. I'm quoting him here. If a politician is holding a rally in a park, a traditional public forum, it doesn't follow that he must permit critics to share the stage with him. And then later in the same piece, he says, even if Twitter were a public forum, it doesn't follow that anyone has to share their corner of that forum with anyone else. What do you make of that analogy?
I think that's actually a more powerful type of consideration. But again, I think it's the physical space stuff that is really there. So I think, in effect, if Trump wants to rent the public building for a rally, he doesn't have to allow his opponents to come in and to throw things off. I believe that that's perfectly unexceptional because that's going to be given to everybody, whether he's president of the United States. But by the same token, by virtue of the fact that you control this particular forum, you can't people from voicing their objections outside the hall every time they hear something booing or yelling or hissing, so long as they don't interfere with what's taking place inside. And what this is, the Twitter stuff is more like people on the lawn outside of the arena rather than people sitting in the particular arena. And so I would think it would be absolutely, utterly improper, to give you an analogy, if somebody could hack into the situation and start to disrupt the Trump tweets themselves, which would be the equivalent of yelling and screaming. That would be utterly impermissible. The president, like anybody else, can control his own voice. And in fact, that's, of course, what the point is. The president controls this stuff. He doesn't control the comment space. I think it would be an interesting question as to whether or not the president could ask Twitter people, please don't have any comments broadcast. From time to time, the Hoover Institution had a policy of not publishing any comments. I think that's perfectly okay. But the president wants it both ways. He wants to generate the hot press from favorable comments, and he wants the bad ones to stay away. And I think that's probably a bit much too much to last. Now, I want to make it very clear. I think on balance, this opinion is right. But the novelty of the circumstances, I think, is actually more important. So my view is that the Trump people all made respectable arguments. I don't think that they were frivolous. But in the end, I think the combination of bad analogies like the one that David French made have to be rejected. And also, to some extent, the distinctive nature of the allocation of power in Twitter between the basic tweets and the comments section are such that what the court did was to make the right kind of decision. I think you get a little bit more political debate out of this thing, and I don't see anything here which is truly disruptive, as would be the case, for example, if the Trump opponent opponents were allowed to attend his campaign rallies, and in the middle of his best punchlines, get up and wave their flags around, showing how much of a protest they start to take place. And by the way, if you're on a public park and you've got a permit to use it for your political rally, your opponents are not allowed to trash it either, any more than they're allowed to trash you when you go on the Berkeley campus.
To your point about the novelty of the circumstances, I'll have you end us on a much broader question, perhaps even excessively general, but I just want to get your gut reaction to this. So you and I did a show a few weeks ago about whether or how antitrust laws should be applied to big tech companies. We were talking today about how political speech should be handled online. There's also this other big controversy, which I don't think we've ever talked about whether social media companies should be considered publishers or platforms. In all these cases, you will hear some people say, you know, the technology has changed so fundamentally that we need a whole new body of law. And I wonder how you think about the relationship between changes in technology and changes in law.
That's a very big question. And the answer is, I think it tends to be on balance somewhat overstated. So right now, there's a lot of questions about there about how the antitrust law is going to apply to Amazon, to Apple. I think Facebook and one other company, one of the big ones, Google, you know, FANG companies or whatever they're called. And look, some of them, they're all quite different kinds of cases. Amazon is a traditional seller. There are people who would like to endow it with invincibility, but it turns out that they cut out certain lines when they're not profitable. They stumble into other kinds of markets. They have small competitors who chip away at niche markets, which they can't fight. Big guys are very hard to fight, are very disadvantaged in fighting little guys. The simple analogy is if you're an elephant, it's very hard to stamp out an ant, even though it's pretty easy to stamp out an animal the size of a gorilla. And so the smallness and the flexibility of the market for them, being the antitrust stuff, is not very good. With Facebook, I mean, there are many other people who would come in. Do we want to say that they've got themselves a monopoly? The answer is they may or they may not. But there's also a position in the antitrust law which says if you came by your monopoly position through imagination thrift and you didn't do it by collusive acquisitions or something of the sort, then it's perfectly okay. It's a case called Grinnell which said that, very influential. There are many people today who disagree with that. They're saying this is such a danger. I don't care how you get it. You still have it. That's more in the European mode than ours. But you're going to have this huge fight. And then, of course, you're going to have the fight as to exactly how big a market does Facebook have, are there competitors in niches, and so forth. With respect to Apple, I mean, you know, they've got a very powerful operating system, but there are other systems out there, MS-DOS or whatever else it is. I think it's going to be hard to sort of treat them as though they're a monopolist, particularly since entry in the tech business is not wildly difficult, at least in some portions of it, and you see it. There was a case called against Qualcomm, which I thought was a terrible decision by Judge Lucy Koh out in San Jose, in which she said these guys were monopolists because of the way in which they priced their various services, which I thought was an absolute absurdity under the circumstances. They faced successful competition from some companies. Other companies basically blow up, but it's because they don't have very, very good products and so forth. And so we've gotten three. And what was the other one? Google. It's kind of difficult because, again, there are other rival platforms out there. People want to say that they advance their monopoly practices by using preferences for their own related products when everybody does a search. But the argument on the other side is not irrelevant. If they're allowed to structure it so they get advantageous gains from the searches, they're going to improve their search engines because they're going to be able to get a larger rate of return from them. And so there's this constant struggle in the antitrust law. We want to encourage monopoly. We don't want it to be abused. Well, how do you draw the balance? It's the same problem that you face with patents. We give pioneer patents, which have a lot of monopoly power, more protection than marginal patents. Why is that? Because we would rather have a monopolist in a new field than nobody in that new particular field. And so we go the other way. My own current judgment about this is there'll be a lot of talk and there will be relatively little action because it's going to be extremely difficult to find a policy. If you tried to think back to the Microsoft case in 1998 where they found monopolization, they couldn't figure out what to do with the remedies, and they made a complete mess of that by the time that they were done. So my guess is that's what's going to happen is they're not going to be a Elizabeth Warren, let's break up the Yankees kind of situation. There will be marginal adjustments in particular cases where some particular abuse attaches enough attention, and there's a widespread consensus that this is something that ought to be changed. That's my current view on this stuff. If you read somebody like Tim Wu, he finds an antitrust goblin in every cabinet. I tend to think that it's overstated. Lena Khan wrote this article about Amazon in the New York Times story. Be afraid, Mr. Bezos, be very afraid, because Lena's coming after you. It turned out to be a pretty conventional argument in which I think she was mostly wrong. It's going to be a real fight. And remember, there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are well-to-do Democrats who realize that if the antitrust goblin comes and hits the tech companies, many of these companies who are in a sort of complicated ecosystem with them are going to find themselves prejudiced as well. So I think it's going to be constantly a pot that's boiling, but I don't think it's one that's going to be boiling over.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.